Good afternoon. Let's go ahead and begin. This is a public rulemaking hearing held pursuant to the State Administrative Procedure Act, specifically Section 24-4-103, Colorado Revised Statutes. The date is Monday, August 3, 2009. The time is 2:04 p.m. We're meeting in the Secretary of State's Blue Spruce Conference Room, 1700 Broadway, Denver, Colorado. My name is Bill Hobbs. I'm Deputy Secretary of State, and I'll chair the meeting today in accordance with the rulemaking notice that was published in the Colorado Register on June 30, 2009. To my right, of course, is Secretary Bernie Buescher. And also, while I'm doing introductions, also at the table to my immediate left is Wayne Munster, Acting Director of the Elections Division. And then to the Secretary's right is Hillary Rudy with the Elections Division. And to Hillary's right is Andrea Geiger, also of the Elections Division. The purpose of the hearing today is to receive public comments on proposed amendments to the state's Secretary of State's election rules. As stated in the original notice issued on June 30th, there are a number of subjects that are covered by the proposed rules, including document retention, voting by mail, voting by uniformed and overseas electors, identification, provisional voting, and so forth. Basically, these proposed rules are a number of items that have either come up as we have faced questions about election procedures and election law, or in some cases these are rules that are proposed in order to implement legislation adopted by the General Assembly during the session earlier this year. I would note that the original notice of rulemaking on June 30th, we included a draft of the proposed rules. We did an updated, or we published an updated version of the proposed rules on July 29th. And a copy of that updated draft of the proposed rules is on the table by the door. And also on the table is a sign-up sheet for anybody who wishes to testify. If you do testify, please be sure to identify not only your name, but who you represent, if you do represent someone. This is a formal rulemaking hearing. The meeting is audio recorded, and the comments, all comments become a part of the official rulemaking record. The hearing is also being broadcast over the Internet. We have received, I believe, some. Have we received some written comments? We have not yet received written comments. And we may, I think something to be decided at the end of the rulemaking hearing is whether or not we leave the rulemaking record open after the close of the hearing today for the receipt of additional written comments. But we'll come back to that. Maybe just a few comments about the proposed rules just for the record. I might point out where some of the rules are being proposed in furtherance of particular legislation. There are amendments to Rule 2.15. This is on page 3. Let me back up. Page 2, amendments to Rule 2.12. Those amendments relating to the address confidentiality program are proposed to implement House Bill 08-1274, I believe. Then on page 3, amendments to Rule 2.15 relate to this year's House Bill 1018. On page 4, there are proposed changes to Rule 6.5 dealing with the designation of ballot issues and ballot questions. Those changes are proposed in order to implement House Bill 09-1326. At the bottom of page 5, there's an amendment to Rule 12.5.2 that is related to House Bill 09-1216. Let's see. Then on page 6, there in the middle of the page, amendments to 12.9.3. The change there relates to both House Bill 1186 and House Bill 1336 this year. And the next set of proposed changes to rule that relate to Rule 12.7, those changes relate to House Bills 1336 and 1337. And there's a number of other changes that relate to 1336 and 1337. Not to belabor all of the detail, I'm giving the flavor of it, I guess, but page 7, Rule 13.12, the changes there are intended to implement House Bill 09-1216. And then on page 8, beginning on line 22, the changes to Rule 15.1 are intended to implement House Bill 1326 from this year. And let me see if there's any other legislation or legislatively related rule changes. I think that's it. The other changes, I think, probably in general, I would say, relate not necessarily to legislation, but to questions that have arisen, the questions that the Elections Division has been presented with. So with that background, I think I'd like to turn to public comment, and I'll open it up for public comment. I'll turn to the sign-up sheet. I have some people that have signed up that they won't testify, and some people have signed up that they might testify. So I'll start with the people who signed up and said they would testify. Mark Gruskin, you're first on the list. Welcome.
Secretary, Mr. Hobbs, if I'd had a tie, I would have worn it today. I hope that won't undermine my comments. I know that Elena Nunez of Colorado Common Cause will be speaking to you, and I just want to say that I'm pretty sure I endorse her comments. The comments I know she's going to make in terms of some definitions I think are warranted and helpful. In that regard, we believe that completeness in these regulations is always helpful. I represent Colorado Citizens for Integrity, and Citizens for Integrity was involved in House Bill 1326. I believe Rule 15 is the only rule that really addresses the issue of paid circulators and how the regulation that the Secretary is now authorized to undertake would go forth. I'd like to provide some written comments for the Secretary to consider if I could. In addition to the Common Cause remarks about clarifying that these requirements apply to third-party circulators, and in that regard, I would just note that the legislature used the word person in House Bill 1326 in describing the affected parties, and therefore we think that the proposal that Ms. Nunez will give to you makes a lot of sense. We think there are two other just clarifying provisions. There's certainly nothing wrong with this rule as it stands. But 15.1.3 talks about the governance of the statute, Section 1-40-135. And again, just for clarity's sake, we think that the Secretary has certain authority over the hearing process where there are violations of this requirement. I would just put that reference in there because I think it's clearly within the statutory authority of the Secretary. And it seems to me that these rules obviously are not going to add to the authority of the Secretary, but they're going to put people on notice as to what they can expect. To the extent that this is a new system, probably the more notice, the better. In the same regard, 15.1.4 deals with the required filings in the Secretary's office and talks about the list of circulators and notaries. But as you know, there is also a requirement that there be filed with the Secretary certain information relating to the compensation scheme. And to the extent that that's true, we just thought that it would be helpful to also put that in the rules and reference it specifically so that someone new to Colorado or someone new to the business of paid circulation would know how broad their obligations are, how narrow, so there aren't inadvertent failures to comply. Lastly, I would endorse the suggestion that you made, Mr. Hobbs, in terms of what you might be open to, keeping the record open. I think we just went through a rulemaking process, and as someone who took advantage of the opportunity to file by 5 o'clock, I think I filed at 4:48, I will tell you that there was certain clarity that set in about some of those issues after the fact, and I'm hopeful that it was helpful in that rulemaking process, and likewise that you have that opportunity here as well. I have really no other comments, and as I say, I'm endorsing the proposal that Ms. Nunez will bring.
Thank you, Mr. Gruskin. Any questions? Okay, thank you very much. Elena Nunez? Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Elena Nunez. I'm here today on behalf of Colorado Common Cause. We work for open, honest, and accountable government. I actually want to comment on several of the rules, but for clarity's sake, maybe I'll start with 15.1.1 to follow up on Mr. Ruskin's remarks. I think the rule, to the extent that it addresses entities who will be gathering and paying for signatures, is good. I think, though, that it could be a little bit more clear if we just added some language clarifying that a third-party circulator is also subject to the requirements, and they would also be subject to any enforcement mechanisms if there was a violation of the new statute. In many instances, it's not the proponent or the issue committee that directly hires paid circulators and would be following the requirements that are outlined in both rule and statute. They often contract with a third-party circulator who then contracts with other circulators on behalf of many other ballot issues. So for clarity's sake, we think it would be a little bit more specific to say that it's a person who would be following these requirements in 15.1.1 and then have proposed some language on page 2 of the comments that I submitted suggesting the addition of another sentence that just says, if a proponent or an issue committee does contract with a third party to hire circulators to collect signatures, that the third party is responsible for registering as a petition entity and meeting the requirements that are established in statute, just to make it clear where the burden is and also where the enforcement should be. And then just to comment more generally on the rules, the other rules that are proposed, we're generally supportive. We think there's some good things included. Have a couple of places where we just have some questions and would like to see some clarity. First, on Rule 2.7, we appreciate the effort to allow for more inclusiveness of voter registration. We think this is a good rule to say that counties can fill in additional information if they've got that information so as to make a registration complete. We think this is a good step to making sure people are able to vote. For Rule 11.5.4.1, this changes the time frame for when the machines that are going to be audited has to be disclosed, from 24 to 48 hours. We don't necessarily have a problem with this. We're just a little curious as to what the rationale is for it and what the thinking is behind this rule. We think in general that obviously a strong audit is important and it's a good thing. We just would like to know kind of where this is coming from. Also, Rules 12.7.2 and Rules 13.8.1, both of these address the requirement about voters getting notification if they need to require if they need to provide voter identification so that their mail ballot can be processed. We think this is good and supported the statute that created this rule. We just think it would be good to bring in the existing language from Rule 29.1.1, which also gives county clerks the discretion to contact the voter by telephone or by email so that there are multiple avenues for contacting the voter, although in all instances they would need to get written notice by mail. And then for Rule 13.12.2, this is another one where we're just looking for clarification. This is the rule that says that if a mail-in ballot, a voter goes to the polls and they want to vote at an early voting location, they must hand in their mail-in ballot or needs to be voided prior to voting. And our question is just whether it's tracking with the previous language, it says that you physically need to surrender your ballot, or if it's allowable for them to just acknowledge that they would like to vote early and then have that that ballot voided electronically through the poll book or some other means. So we're just looking for clarity in terms of practice, whether this means you physically have to hand over your ballot or if you can just indicate a preference to vote early.
And excuse me for interrupting. I'm sorry.
Sure.
You're referring to the stricken language that
It's in Rule 1312.2, the language that says that a voter can vote early. Let's see.
13.
It's the last two lines, line 33 and 34, the mail-in ballot must be voided prior to issuing the early voting ballot. And it's just a question as to whether that physically requires a surrender of the ballot or if it's I can just go up to the judge and say I'd like to vote early and it can be voided through the poll book.
Okay.
And our preference, we'd support the rule assuming that you could do that without having to physically provide your ballot since the voters may not always have their ballot or be able to produce it.
Okay.
And then finally, just on Rule 13.13.2, this has to do with notification for voters who opt into the permanent vote by mail list. We've seen a lot of confusion on this in terms of which elections are subject to the permanent vote by mail list and which ones are not. We support this rule as it's written. We just think there could be additional clarity, perhaps by asking the designated election official to send voters a notice once a year that explains which elections are subject to the permanent vote by mail list and in which elections they would need to request a ballot, just so that a voter who thinks they're signing up to vote by mail in all elections actually knows which elections they're voting in. That I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Any questions for Ms. Nunez? And it always helps. Thank you for the written comments as well. You went pretty quick there, but at least we can go back and digest from what you provided us, I think. One thing that you did ask about the change from 24 hours to 48 hours on the audit before we notify the counties of the machines to be audited, I think. I don't remember specifically, but I think we've really found it difficult to be able to do that. I think that was just as a practical matter, providing just a little more time. It's a pretty labor-intensive process, as I recall. Is that
That's
fair?
That's correct, yeah.
Although I would comment that I think with new legislative requirements dealing with post-election audits, I expect that we'll be revisiting that probably through the new Best Practices and Vision Commission as well to flesh out the audit in more detail.
Great.
That could have some impact on what is required of this office, I think. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Faith Gross? Oh, I'm sorry, you did just sign up just to that you're here. Thank you. anyone else wish to testify? Everybody else is a maybe or a no that signed up. Yes, Margie, if you'd like to come forward, if you'd like to testify.
My name is Margaret Johansson. I'm from Boulder, Colorado, and I'm with Coloradans for Voting Integrity. On 11-5-4-1, which was mentioned earlier, my question isn't so much the change from 24 hours to 48 hours, but simply that it's not entirely clear whether notice could be given before the end of the election. It doesn't say after specifically, and it seems obvious that giving people notice before the end of the election wouldn't be a good idea, but it does seem to be vague there.
So you would like that clarified so that that notice would have to be after the close of the polls?
Right.
Okay.
So, for obvious reasons. Then on 12.5.1, it looks like the new language eliminates the need for an affidavit. And people who seem to know more about mail ballots have said that the ability to request that something be sent, that the ballot be sent to a different address from the one on record might might allow people to vote falsely because the person in whose name they were voting wouldn't necessarily know that their address had been changed on them. So I would, if that's true, I would suggest that the presence of an affidavit might give you a little more confidence. And also we have a rule that the first vote that comes in is the one that counts. So if you do have somebody voting for somebody else and the first person doesn't necessarily know about it until it's too late, that might be a problem.
Let me just see. Ms. Rudy, did you have a comment about that?
I think I would just comment that the intent is not to eliminate the requirement for an affidavit. Rather, it's just to account for the fact that in legislation this past session, the affidavit for a mail ballot and mail-in ballot was actually harmonized to the same affidavit. Oh. So there's no requirement now for a separate affidavit. So.
Okay, sorry. I would make the suggestion because the only record that the public seems to be able to get on what the new legislation was is online now, and it's a list only of the changes. So it's a little more complicated for us to figure out what you're responding to and your changes. And if, when it comes this early in the year, if you could just make a note, new legislation or something, would make it much easier for people to read, I think.
In the proposed rules?
Right.
As a matter of practice, so that you can relate the rule
right.
changes.
I mean, once the whole 09 legislation is online, it's not that hard to check. But.
Mm-hmm.
Then 25.3.7. I wonder about the unique identification number for tracking.
I'm sorry, repeat the rule number again, please.
25.3.7.
Okay, thank you.
And I wondered whether a unique identification number for tracking and auditing compromises privacy, which, as we know, is part of the Colorado Constitution. It's required. And with email voting, that becomes a huge problem.
Okay.
And my last comment is 25.3.9. It requires results that are combining the different types of mail-in ballots, faxed, mailed, and transmitted via ETS, emailed, which has to do with the military system. And I would think it would be helpful to have those broken down so you could track more precisely what the usage was of those different types. And those are all my comments. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. Anyone else? Clerk Arrowsmith?
Jack Arrowsmith, Douglas County Clerk and Recorder. I have just a couple of comments quickly, if I could. On page 2 of 14, 2.12.31.1, the only thing I would say here is it somewhat presupposes that we're able to utilize information in the polling place from SCORE. We know we can't do that. So as we move forward with identifying this voter and trying to get them the proper split, we ought to think about how that will look and work in the polling place if we're not able to look that information up easily. On page 5 of 14 on your chart, the only thing I would say there on that top chart below, we talk about subdivisions which are wholly within the county. And then right above it says political subdivisions greater than the county. I would suggest maybe changing that to crossing county lines to be consistent with that bottom reference in the chart. On page 11 of 14, 25.3.6, talks about merging a Uokava voter with 10 voted ballots. I would ask that the Secretary of State give some thought to what the best practices are on which 10 ballots we're going to merge that with. I can think of any number of reasons that some 10 ballots would be the wrong 10 ballots to merge that vote with. And then on page 12 of 14, rule 25.4.2, again, I would ask for some clarification on election night when we're getting a request at 5 o'clock for a replacement ballot. What does that mean in terms of us contacting the voter? Are we required to do that before the end of voting at 7 o'clock? Can that be extended past that time? Do we presuppose that that person will get the ballot back to us by close of business, 7 o'clock on election night, or is that somewhat different as well? Those are my comments.
Questions? Okay, thank you very much, Jack. Anyone else wish to testify? Seeing none, then I think we could leave the rulemaking record open, and I'm not sure on our time. This being so early in the month, I would say at least to the end of the week. So we'll leave the rulemaking record open until 5 o'clock on Friday, August 7th. So any written comments, please provide them to the Secretary of State's office. They can be emailed to Andrea Geiger. That's Andrea.Geiger, G-Y-G-E-R, at sos.state.co.us. Or mailed or dropped off, of course. So thank you all very much. Appreciate the feedback and look forward to getting some more before 5 o'clock on Friday. For the record, the time is 2:32 p.m. Thank you.